The Toffees Come Unstuck. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week we've once again got a full house. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke? Okay, so it turns out that Carl's actually running a bit late. The opening of the show is always done pre-recording, so I'm going to have to turn it over to Matthew, but Carl does join us about 20 minutes in, so it's a full house eventually. Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, it's fortnight ago. Sadly, Fulham results haven't quite picked up in the way that I hoped they would have. And sadly, one of the bad results has come against one of our guests today. So I'm sure that's going to be very exciting for me to talk about. But other than that, all is good.
And of course, joining you this week is Palace fan Max. Fulham fan Matthew's just alluded to what we're going to be starting with. You must be in quite a chipper mood, Max.
Yes, yeah, very much. I've been bouncing around with a smile on my face all weekend.
Okay, so before we chat all things Pod Derby and more, I best do the social media bits first, otherwise we'll be talking into the abyss once more. So first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. If you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like what you hear, leave a review so we move up the league table. And if you're not a fan of all things Apple, you can find me on SoundCloud and Audioboom. While the easiest way to find all the links is by going to realfootballcast.com. Also, I just want to give a shout out to Freelance Football Opportunities on Twitter at FFOps. If you're a freelancer and looking for paid jobs, they do an excellent weekly newsletter in return for a Patreon contribution of roughly £3 a month. I cannot recommend this enough in this current climate. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? I think we should reflect on our first Pod Derby of the season, and that means a review of Fulham versus Palace. So Matthew, if I can start with you, what was your assessment of activities at the Cottage this weekend?
Do we have to?
Yes,
fine. Unfortunately. Fair enough. This is what I brought up as well. Yeah, it's a standard Fulham procedure, unfortunately, at the moment. Everything looks good for the first 5 minutes. Then our defence is torn apart by a very good move by Wilfried Zaha and Gyro Riedewald. I'm sure Max will pronounce it a lot better than I would. Them two. And then it's just all downhill from there. We had a couple of chances. Mitrovic missed a sitter, which he wouldn't have done 12 months ago. He seems to have been off the boil. Then when it gets to 2-0, it's really game over. And yeah, it's a mountain to climb. And I'm hoping that this isn't a regular occurrence going forward. But something tells me, unless something drastically changes, that it's going to be exactly that.
Well, Max, I would imagine the mood for you, as I said earlier, would be quite chipper, because not only did you win on Saturday, but you've quietly snuck up to eighth, because you've sort of not been trailblazing or, you know, swashbuckling, but you're getting results, and you'd have to say quite a decent start to the campaign thus far.
Yeah, it was a good performance. I was pretty pleased with it. I think we also got 10 shots on target, which is the most we've had for about 400 years, so I was really pleased with that. Yeah, and we have started the season pretty well as well. Basically, I know you should never what if and look back at games and say, oh, we should have had more there, because every football fan does that, right? But we had a really good chance to get a point against Everton had we not been denied by a pretty unlucky penalty, which they've since changed the rules to reflect the fact it was such a poor decision. And then against Brighton, we conceded a 95th minute deflection. And we'd have three more points if we'd have managed to see those games out with a draw and a win. So yeah, I've been really enthused by how it went. Not only was I pleased by the fact that we won and got the win over the line against Fulham, I was also really enthused by the fact our attacking performance seemed to be kicked into life after a bit of a drab performance the previous week.
So, Matthew, I think we need to talk about Scotty P, because when managers are promoted from the Championship, there's always a case of, so what have you done for me lately? You know, all those efforts from the season before are very quickly forgotten if results don't go that way. And we're nearly at that point already with Fulham. So, I know it's a difficult question and probably one you don't really want to answer, but how much time has Scott Parker got on the Fulham touchline?
I think it's realistically until the international break, which is coming up very soon, like mid-November. I don't know how many Premier League games there are between that. But I know it's West...
Two or three max.
Two or three, right. But I know it's West Brom, who are, you know, relegation candidates, fellow relegation candidates, next Monday. And I think if he doesn't get a result there, then I think that's it. Now, I've said from the beginning that given everything that was stacked against him, the fact that we came off via the playoffs, which is always a disadvantage for promoted teams, the fact that it was a quick turnaround in the summer, more of a disadvantage, and the shambles that is Tony Khan, head of recruitment, ahead of him, I will never call for Scott Parker to go. And the way that he had a new three-year contract handed to him over the summer is a sort of, you know, it's a long-term project. So even if he does take us down, we have the faith in him to take us back up. Similar to, you know, Sean Dyche and all that sort of stuff back in the past with Burnley. But I do think that the writing's on the wall for him. Again, I'm not calling for it, but I just think the way that things are going, it does seem inevitable that if results don't pick up quickly, then the international break is usually the time that it happens, and it's all sort of coming together now that it seems inevitable at this point.
Yeah, it's looking that way, unfortunately. You know, it would be harsh, but, you know, football is a results business and Fulham aren't getting results. And with one relegation already happening two seasons ago, they don't want to be caught in this sort of yo-yo cycle. No matter how much money they get from TV and the like, they want to try and make a proper fist of it. And if you've got an international break, what, 8-9 games into the season, you've still got three quarters left, you might be able to turn the ship around. But Max, in terms of the game itself, I think the biggest flashpoint was the sending off of Fulham's Kamara. Now, initially, it was a yellow card. A quick look to the monitor, it's upgraded to a red. Do you think that was the correct decision?
Oh, I'm gonna give you a bit of a wishy-washy answer and say, no, basically, I'm not sure. To be honest, if I had to pick one, I think I would say yes, it was a red, and it's kind of mitigated by the fact that clearly I don't think it was a malicious tackle. It wasn't intent to cause harm, you know, in the way that, for example, Ashley Barnes stuck his elbow into Toby Alderweireld's head. So there is that. So I'm not saying it was, you know, violent or malicious or anything, but it was reckless. And although it does look worse in slow motion, and when you replay it lots of times like that, I think it was probably just about a red. You know, it was pretty similar to Luca Dina's challenge on Kyle Walker-Peters. It's in a really nasty area. And if he'd gone through with a bit more force, Eze could have been really badly injured. The ball wasn't really anywhere near. It was just a bit reckless, and so probably worthy of a red card. Although I do have a little bit of sympathy for him because, as I say, I don't think it was premeditated or anything like that.
Well, Matthew, Will Sahar starts the season is already better than the whole of last season in terms of goal scoring output. So I guess Roy Hodgson will be hoping this rich vein of form continues for a while yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think some of it does sort of come down to the players that he's playing with. I think the introduction of Eze, for instance, has been sensational for someone like Zaha in his ability to sort of create chances and open spaces for him, and having Batshuayi up front with him as, you know, the assist that he gave on the weekend was just proof that, you know, they've played together in the past, and it's one of these partnerships that really could form into something. Even the likes of Andros Townsend, who played a role in it as well. I think it's just a case of now that he's finally got the players around him that, you know, no, some of them were there last year, but I think this group now is just, you know, going to take Zaha, I was going to say to that next level, but I don't think it's really to the next level, just back to the level he was beforehand, which was a very, very good player.
And when we talk of a rich vein of form, that's something that Everton failed to continue on Sunday as they were beaten away at Southampton. So, Max, I think it's easy to say it was their worst performance when you consider that they are still top of the table. So something was always going to give eventually. But where did it go wrong in week six when it didn't between weeks one and five?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a tricky one. They didn't have Andre Gomes, excuse me, and he is a really solid presence in centre mid. You know, he's 6'2", so he can do the kind of the hard work, the hard yards, the graft. But he's also a really classy operator. I really rate him highly. And they went with one more attacking player, and I think that showed. Also, I think it's maybe a little bit harsh on Southampton to not mention their performance, because on their day, they are a really, really good side, and they completely nullified Everton. They seem to be first to every second ball, every 50-50 they were winning. They have got a bit of an edge with kind of players like Danny Ings and James Ward-Prowse, obviously, who scored, and Yannick Vestergaard. Basically, Southampton conceded, I think it was 5 to Spurs, and they looked really, really poor. And then since then, they've dropped their centre-back, Jack Stevens, and brought in Yannick Vestergaard, 6'7", giant European. And he seems to have solidified the defence, but they were really solid, and they're getting the makings of a team who are playing really consistently. It's kind of the same players, but with a few new signings. And so they're looking really strong.
Well, this is it, Matthew, because we shouldn't really look at the Everton negatives. That probably makes for a better story. We should be lauding Southampton, especially when you consider that a year removed from that, they were getting smashed by less than 9-0. So not just a turnaround in this first part of the season, but over the course of 365 days, Ralph and his players have, you know, they've turned, not, well, I'll tell you 360, you'll be back to where you started. So at least a 180 turn in terms of results.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of it is also, you know, everything getting back to normal, as it were. Because I know in the first couple of weeks of the season, we were talking about, you know, these strange results as people, you know, didn't quite have the pre-season. Players weren't totally fit. That's why you had these, again, these weird results popping up. I think now it's just a case of everything getting back to the way it was last season. I think, you know, last season, after Hasenhüttl had turned stuff around after the 9-0 defeat, a 2-0 win over Everton is probably what you'd expect. And Everton are probably in a case of, again, this is praising Southampton, not knocking Everton. But I do think Everton are starting to get back to where they were. As it were. I don't think they were always going to be title contenders throughout the season. It was just, everything just fell in their favour. Whereas now I think things just get back to normal for them. And this is just, you know, one of the first, you know, quite normal results that we're likely to see from a side like Everton.
So, Max, in terms of Southampton's players, we usually focus on Danny Ings on this show, maybe because of laziness from the scriptwriter myself. But I want to focus on Che Adams this time, the other half of the strike force. He scored on Sunday. He's getting to being a Premier League striker. At first, when he's moved from Birmingham, he proclaimed that Southampton could win the Premier League. And you thought, all right, Che, settle down. And he wasn't quite getting there in terms of goals. But there is progression in his play now.
I'm just putting it out there. Putting it out there.
That's absolutely fine, mate.
I think he is developing into a really good player, and we can't forget he is a young guy. He's obviously done it in the Championship and scored goals for fun down there, but obviously the Premier League is another level. You get less time on the ball, you get less space, chances are come to you less frequently than they would in the Championship. You know, defenders will probably be better. And so he did struggle at first, maybe weighed down by the price tag or the expectation or the pressure. But he really came into his own post-Project Restart towards the end of last season. And he was really getting on for matching Danny Ings for goals, which was a really encouraging sign for Southampton. And obviously they've got a lot of competition up front, you know, likes of Michael Obafemi and Shane Long and Dan and Lindulu, who came on at the weekend. So they've got lots of numbers there, but he seems to have nailed down the spot next to Danny Ings. And if Southampton can get him performing anywhere near the level that Ings performed at last season and almost won the Golden Boot, then they'll be absolutely delighted and Adams will have got a lot of goals.
So, Matthew, it was another game for Everton that ended with 10 men for them. So do you think Lucas Digne should have been sent off for his challenge on Kyle Walker-Peters? With that said, is there a mitigating circumstance where it's a slip and not really malice, but still looks nasty all the same? What do you think?
Yeah, I personally come under, because I know Gary Lineker tweeted about it in the aftermath. I can't remember what he exactly said. You can't, you know, have a clash of legs or something like that. It was worded along those lines. I think that's what it was. And we talked about the Kamara thing earlier. I think if the Kamara sending off had stayed a booking, I think that the Digne one probably would have been a booking as well. But I just think the precedent was set there. I didn't think, you know, there wasn't much malice or anything. It was just, again, similar to Kamara, there wasn't a lot in it for me. And if it had been a yellow, personally, I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
So, Max, that's 2 weeks in a row now that Everton have seen a man sent off. And don't forget, there's all things Pickford on Van Dijk. We shouldn't forget that either. So, are they in danger now of being labelled a dirty team? Does Ancelotti need to have a word? Or, if he does have a word, do they start to lose their early edge?
That's an interesting one. I don't know if Ancelotti has got a problem. There is maybe a little theme of players being sent off, and obviously Pickford missed out on one the other week. Players like, you know, Pickford and Mina and Gomez and Alan definitely have a little bit of a physical edge, and you know that strong competitiveness. But you need that in the Premier League. I also mainly agreed with Ancelotti when he was talking about. The Digne incident potentially being a reaction to Pickford not being sent off for the Van Dijk incident. Now, Ancelotti went way over the top when he was talking about Digne's red card being a joke and this and that. But I do think there is something in what he was saying about the outpouring of grief and scorn and fury about Pickford's tackle on Van Dijk. And don't get me wrong, it should have been a red. He should be banned. It should have been a red. But I think the fact that it was on Virgil van Dijk, who's Liverpool's golden boy and, you know, the title holder's key player and all of that, I think that has overblown it a little bit out of proportion, especially because Liverpool fans are maybe never having the right sense of proportion. In any case, they could be accused of that. So in that instance, I do think that there was maybe a reaction from the referees, thinking, right, we can't be seen to doing that again. We need to clamp down the next time there's a, you know, potentially 50-50 tackle from an Everton player. We need to show that we're not going to make the same mistake again.
And Matthew, talking of early edge, Dominic Calvert-Lewin was rather blunt at St Mary's. Now, is that more of a case of a simple day off for him, or have Southampton identified how to keep him quiet and that blueprint can be rolled out to the rest of the division?
I think it's a combination of factors. You know, as I said earlier, I think Everton are starting to get back to where they, you know, back to where they were last season, and it being a normal result. I think that's sort of the same. Everyone started to work out. Similar to James Rodriguez, who wasn't exactly the greatest performance from him. It was okay, but not what we've seen the first couple of weeks, when everyone's saying he's the greatest foreign import of all time, sort of thing. Now that people are starting to work out how to play Everton, it's all starting to roll into one. So I think Calvert-Lewin is probably one of the detractors of that. So I don't think, I think he'll still have a very good season, but I don't think we'll see, what was it, like 6 goals in 5 games to start the season. I don't think we're going to see him going through any sort of runs like that, carrying on forward. I would also like to say, maybe it's because the fact that I withheld Kazoo last time,
yes,
I was out, as the sort of curse from it. So let's test this theory out. Dominic Calvert-Lewin. There you go. There's the Kazoo. If he scores this weekend, you know it's on me.
This is pod magic.
This is pod gold. This is exactly what the shareholders want. And they also...
It's very much the reverse of your kiss of death from last season.
Absolutely, absolutely. Strange things happen on the show. And also, we've stitched Carl back into the show. He's running late, but he's here now. So, Carl, your first question is that a defeat for Everton sees Liverpool move up to the same points in the table. So they had to win the hard way. Do you think their change of shape on Saturday made life harder than it needed to be?
Yeah, I guess obviously the Van Dijk injury has possibly given them a slight headache, isn't it? That they wanna just try and maybe see how they can kind of get past or get over that injury to one of their key players. It probably caused them a slight issue, because in truth, Sheffield United were very unlucky, weren't they, in the end, to come away with nothing from that game. And I think this is where we might see Liverpool just kind of, you know, get themselves over the line a few times this season with Van Dijk out. You know, I think they're going to be very concerned about how they can be at the back. I don't think there's any problems with them going forward. But I think we're already seeing from the way the games are going, I don't think this will be a romp like last season as such, where, you know, you get the impression they could go deep into the season where they'll be unbeaten. I think this is going to be a bit of a topsy-turvy season, and, you know, some teams will play well in patches. And I think Liverpool will be one of those teams that they might not ever always play well, but they'll probably just have enough to get some results over the line, a bit like this weekend. But we have seen, I think, from this game at the weekend, if you take Van Dijk out of that side, then I think Liverpool are a little bit easier to get at, and possibly, you know, a lot more teams won't fear him as much as they would have with him in the side. So Sheffield United were unlucky. But yeah, I think Liverpool just tinkered and it might have just knocked them out of their stride a little bit.
Yes, of course. They've passed the first post-Van Dijk test, shall we say, but there's going to be many more to come. So also there's going to be a lot tougher opposition. And Matthew, the biggest talking point from that game was the penalty that Fabinho ended up giving away. Now, he has been drafted into centre-back, something you'll probably see for quite a while now. With him being the guilty party, the question is, was it really inside the box?
I think this is going to be one of those grime, even though I've said in previous weeks that us fans have to know the rules. I think this is going to be one where I'm actually going to have to play ignorant here. I'm not 100% sure what the ruling of the thing is, because Ollie McBurnie had a foot on the line. So I don't know if this is a case of, you know, in any, you know, in any and all situations, if it happens on the line, then that means it's in the box sort of thing. If that's the case,
that's my belief.
Similar to like the whole of the ball has to be over the whole of the line. As long as you have some of your foot on the line, then it, if that is indeed the rule, then it was absolute. Then it was absolutely a penalty. I don't think there can be any doubts about it. But what should be noted is the fact that the referee, whose name is escaping me right now,
Mike Dean,
gave a free Mike Dean, obviously on a Saturday night, obviously. Mike Dean gave the free kick initially and then went to VAR to sort of prove it. This is one of the cases where VAR got it right, but no one seems to be talking about that because everyone's talking about every other decision. But VAR got it right. Let's just brush that under the carpet. No one needs to talk about that.
So, Max, the tough start for Sheffield United continues. They picked up just 1 point across their last 9 matches when you look at the end of last season and this. So, why can't Chris Wilder's men find the same levels as the main part of last season?
Well, we saw last season that their fantastic rise up the table, you know, from the Championship and finishing almost in Europe, it was hugely based on their solid defence. And they've lost a couple of key members of it. They've obviously lost Dean Henderson, who's on loan from Man United. He's now returned to Old Trafford, back to his parent club. And Aaron Ramsdale is a decent replacement. You know, he's a good young keeper. He's got potential, but he's not Dean Henderson. He's not at the same level. And they've also lost Jack O'Connell. And Jack O'Connell is a really big part of how they play. Obviously, I didn't realise it was going to be such a huge loss for them when he got injured, but they've really, really struggled to make it work. And they've supplemented their defensive numbers. You know, they signed the two wing-backs from Derby. They signed Jaden Bogle and Max Lowe. And they haven't quite figured out exactly how they're going to do it. You know, they tried Jack Robinson at left centre-back. Now they're moving Ender Stevens, who's usually a left wing-back. They moved him back to left centre-back and put the young kid, Max Lowe, at left wing back. And then he went off and they had to try Ben Osborne at left wing back, who's normally a centre midfielder. So they haven't quite figured out the right balance in defence. And also, with most people are forgetting that Henderson last season, that they conceded a fair amount of shots, Sheffield United, but the ones that did get through, Henderson was able to repel, and Ramsdale hasn't been quite able to replicate that so far.
Then again, when we talk about same levels, I think we can apply that same statement to Manchester City, Carl, because the sight of Sergio Aguero coming off again injured is not something that Pep Guardiola will have wanted to see last Saturday lunchtime.
No, definitely. I mean, he is a massive loss for City because, you know, I think I said it last season, you know, for me, Gabriel Jesus isn't going to be a good enough backup who can come in and fill the void. And when Aguero's in that side, they look a completely different animal. Without him, they kind of look a little bit timid up front. You know, it's OK if you've got Sterling on form, Mahrez playing well, but if they're not quite hitting it, then once Aguero's not in that side, then I think City really struggle for goals. I am surprised that they're not potentially more seriously in the market for another striker because, you know, Aguero is obviously, you know, the clock is ticking as such on how much longer he's got left in the tank there. And I think City will now really need to start turning their attention to finding themselves a new focal man up front who possibly stays a little bit more injury free and is obviously the future for them going forward as their main striker. Because I just don't think the players they've got can cut it if he's not in the side. And as we're already seeing, it looks like now his body is starting to kind of, you know, ache and pain a little bit, and he's going to miss more and more games. So City, I think, without him have really got problems. And I think they will, come January, they might need to look at bolstering that squad if they can with a new striker.
Absolutely. Like you say, he's just getting to that age now where the niggles are starting to stack up that little bit more, which then creates more minutes away from the pitch. And City can't really afford that. You know, Jesus is decent, but he's not going to drive you himself to a Premier League title. And Matthew, when you consider City's transfer business this summer, they've looked at more defensive names. Now, you could argue they needed them, but in making their squad more rounded, have they lost a bit of bite at the sharper end of the pitch, shall we say?
Yeah, they did. It's been one of the criticisms for Pep Guardiola the past couple is that he hasn't really sorted out the defence and he hasn't quite been able to work it out. That's why the likes of Fernandinho have had to be dropped into centre-back, because the likes of Stones have had his problems, and Laporte is always in and out of the team. Same with Otamendi. Whereas now he looks to have fixed it with Nathan Ake. It's still not quite there. And yeah, it has probably affected, because with the spending that they have, they were probably going to rely on Sergio Aguero. So they thought, let's fix the defence. We can't really afford to spend a lot more on the attack, so we're going to have to rely on Sergio Aguero, and it's come to bite them. What they do in January, it's going to be interesting, because I can't imagine there being much of a market for any big names, as it were. So this is really going to have to come down on the greatest coach in the world, as he has so proclaimed, Pep Guardiola, to have to coach up and make the rest of the team, the rest of the forwards that they have, better. I think a lot of workload is going to have to fall on the likes of Raheem Sterling to get a lot of goals. Gabriel Jesus, as Carl mentioned, not great. He's going to have to step up. And a bit of a long shot, but it seems he's getting a couple of minutes now. Liam Delap? Rory Delap's son?
Yep.
Playing up front for them? I would not be surprised if he starts getting a couple more minutes, and he's probably going to have to chip in with a couple of goals going forward as well.
So, Max, when we look at Saturday, I guess we've got to give more credit to West Ham, because not only for Saturday's performance, but after losing their first two league matches, I think everyone, even us on this show, are guilty of saying, well, that's it, they're doomed for the next 6-8, they're going to get nothing. But result after result, they're making a mockery of that statement, and I guess more power to them.
Yeah, completely fair play to them, because everyone saw their kind of early losses, their couple of early losses, and then also saw their horrendous run of fixtures, which, by the way, is about to start turning, and they're going to start getting the generally easier games. And it would be really interesting to see how they do there. So everyone looked at their early losses and fixtures and thought, yeah, as you say, they're going to really struggle. They're doomed. They're down already. I think early on in the Premier League season, fans like to proclaim which teams are definitely going to be down. And often it doesn't quite turn out that way, because they've shown a lot of bottle and a lot of fight, and I thought they were very, very good value for their point and for their draw against Man City. It wasn't a complete smash and grab, and what a fantastically well taken goal as well. So yeah, fair play to them.
Carl, I know you're a big fan of Mikel Antonio. You've sung his praises many times, both here and on social media. So what would you like to say about that goal on Saturday?
Yeah, for me, he is a real handful. And, I think if Spurs, if in the summer it had been Spurs were being linked with Antonio to come in as a backup striker for Kane, or, a second striker, I would have been, more than happy. Because he's strong, he's quick, and he is just a major handful. And he does score some really good goals, Remember the first goal he scored to beat us at our place, over the top, was onto it quick, great half volley, in power, keeper no chance. And his finish this weekend was just, again, another finish of just confidence, and a player who he is in a really good streak. He was at the end of last season after the restart. You could say that his goals and his performances were one of the main reasons around West Ham not being in bigger trouble than they were come the end of last season. And he's kind of hit the ground running again this season. I'd be only slightly worried if I was West Ham now if he was to become injured. Because obviously, I think he is their real key focal point and the one player that I think actually worries a lot of defences. So I think they're desperate to keep him fit. But I tell you now, he is playing really well. And, he could be, if he carries on like this, I wouldn't be surprised there's a few bigger clubs looking to eye him up for next season, possibly.
Then again, Matthew, I think credit must also go to Lukas Fabianski for his performance on Saturday. A string of saves, especially at the end, and especially as Andrei Yarmolenko was doing his best to set up a late City winner.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Lukas Fabianski's come under a lot of stick from West Ham. He came in for a lot of it last season because he had that horror game at Anfield where I think he basically gave Liverpool two goals in that game. So yeah, it's good to see that he's come back for it. And he's always been a very good goalkeeper. You know, never quite, you know, world class or, you know, the kind that you put in the top tier of Premier League goalkeepers. But he's always been a very reliable one. It's good to see that he's come, you know, back into form in that sense.
And Max, of course, West Ham would have to make do with a well-earned point after Phil Foden came off the bench and got City's equaliser. So, everyone sings his praises, there's no doubt about that. But how good is he really? I'm not saying I don't see it, but maybe a lack of opportunities don't allow me to see it. So, when does he really make a City start his own every week?
Well, I mean, arguably, he's done that so far. I think he's missed one game so far this season or something like that. But I do really like him. And particularly given they've had a couple of injuries in the attacking areas, for example, with Aguero and Jesus out, they've had to go with Sterling up front, which frees up a spot on the wing where Foden has been playing often. And I think he's definitely good enough to have a starting spot at Man City, even at the tender age he is. And I look forward to seeing him there more often. But yeah, I mean, I think he's only missed a couple of games. I don't think he's missed many. How many has he missed? I mean, he started four games out of five so far, or six, four or five games out of six. So I'll be interesting to see what the others think. But I think he started a fair amount and he's making that place his own.
Okay, let's throw it open to the others for some Foden chat then. Carl, is this what we can hopefully consider for him and for England a breakout season?
I think so, yeah, and I think it needed to be. You know, I think he was gonna reach the point with City where it was either, you know, I need to start playing regularly now and getting regular football, or if not, I might need to start thinking about, you know, do I go somewhere else so that I can get, you know, a regular start in place and the game times that will allow me to kind of break out and show the talent I've got. I think he's had, you know, when he's played for City, I think he's done really well. So I can actually see him starting to get more and more games this season. And then I think, you know, we'd definitely see from next season on, you know, they may kind of sort of build their midfield around him. But he's done everything he can when he does play, you know, scores goals. He's a good passer of a football. He seems to have, you know, good energy, can get up and down. So I do think this will be the season where he kind of starts getting regular football. And I think he needed to, because I say it was, again, he could have become in danger of being one of those players that we're always talking about, but never getting regular football. I think this year he will, but I've been impressed with him so far.
So Matthew, is the end game England building their midfield around Phil Foden, and does that happen this summer?
I think it does. I just want to, you know, echo what Carl said. You know, I've been hearing a lot about, no, I say I, we, societal, have been hearing a lot about Phil Foden for years. I remember him getting a lot of praise. When did Man City beat Arsenal in the League Cup? Was it 2019, that season? So you're looking at, you know, going back two seasons almost, that he's been coming on for like these cameo appearances, last 10 minutes, you know, cup games against Burton Albion and all that sort of stuff. We've been waiting for this to happen. And I think now with David Silva moving out, it was basically inevitable that Phil Foden was going to have to fill that spot in the centre midfield. And the fact that he's going to be playing with, you know, world-class players at Manchester City could only benefit the England squad in a monumental and catastrophic way for me, thinking about it as a Wales fan, because it's written in the stars that Foden and Greenwood are going to be the ones to connect for the winning goal at Wembley next summer. It'll be, you know, zeros to heroes from the whole Iceland incident. And I think Phil Foden does have the talent to really be the guiding light for England. God, I hate myself saying this. To be the guiding light for England for the next 10 to 15 years. I do hate to say it because I do like him. I was just never a fan of the way that Pep Guardiola managed him, because he was this great talent, but he never got on the pitch. Now he's got on the pitch, his talent is blossoming, and it's going to be painful for me because I know what's coming down the line.
Well, I guess, Max, there's a sense of master plan in all of this with Phil Foden, in that, you know, not to point fingers at Chelsea, but he's probably at the right club with the right manager to go through this progressive curve of his career. Because if he was at Chelsea, he becomes just a name which is farmed out to Vitesse Arnhem and maybe Swansea or somewhere. You know, you get the idea. So at least with Guardiola, there's much more of a watch why.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I'm actually really pleased for him that he's managed to get to a club where he's given the opportunity. Because you're right, at Chelsea, you talk about the kind of talent that they've got in that midfield. It's so congested. You know, someone like Billy Gilmore, who looked quite good last season when he was given the odd couple of chances, he's going to be nowhere near the Chelsea squad, let alone team now. And obviously, Jadon Sancho left Man City for Dortmund in search of better opportunities. And that's proven to be a good move, given how his career has gone. But Foden decided to stay, and I'm really pleased for him that he's managed to get some chances. And obviously, although this wouldn't have happened unless Aguero and Jesus were injured, people like Liam Delap, who's already been mentioned, I think he scored in the League Cup, or he scored in one of City's earlier games this season, and he's getting a couple of chances. Obviously, Eric Garcia's coming through, young kid, and getting chances as well, even if he might be off to Barcelona at the end of the season. So Guardiola has shown that, unlike other managers, he is willing to give young players a chance. Mikel Arteta at Arsenal strikes me as another example.
Well, you mentioned Arteta. We're going to Arsenal next, because, Carl, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is turning into Mesut Ozil Mark II. And I mean that in the sense of, get your new contract, get your feet under the table, and life's pretty easy from here on in. He's really going off the boil quite quickly.
Yeah, he has, hasn't he? You know, the performances have dropped a little bit since that new contract has come in. I think the game previous, what I found really worrying from him was actually the lack of kind of what seemed like enthusiasm and effort to get in the game. And it just seemed like the game kind of passed him by. And again, you wouldn't have said this, you know, the game against Leicester was any real different. You know, did he have a big impact on it? Not really. Should he have had a better impact? Yes, he should have done. So I do think, you know, he is a great player for them, and he'll score goals all season long. But as you say, they do want to make sure that he gets back in the sort of form he was before that new contract, because, you know, the last couple of performances we've seen have been, you know, quite woeful, really, from his standards. And that's kind of affected Arsenal in a way, because I think they're kind of relying on him quite heavily for their goals. And as you say, if he dries up or his form dips, then Arsenal could really be in trouble for some goals themselves.
I'll stay with you, Carl, because it seems that Mikel Arteta is invoking the spirit of George Graham at the moment. As you say, the football is just, you know, one note, lacklustre. It's not quite the Arsenal that you'd imagine or expect to see.
Yeah, it's not, you know, one thing we've always been able to say about Arsenal over the years, you know, they've obviously, as we all know, got their defensive frailties, but going forward and playing football, they can and always have been able to play some really nice stuff and some entertaining football. And I say, the last couple of outings from them, they have been really tepid and, you know, not much going for them. You know, no real creativity, no real pace or danger. And you kind of get, you know, it's like hitting someone with feather gloves, haven't they? You know, there's no real danger that they're going to be able to give you the knockout blow. And as you say, I think that they will need to snap out of that very quickly, because, as we know, that is a club where once results don't go your way, it all starts turning a little bit toxic very quickly. You know, you've only got to see your timeline to see, you know, the fan bloods doing their stuff at the weekend. And, you know, you wouldn't fancy facing that every week. So I've been surprised the way they've played, because they weren't playing that badly before. So something's gone on there, because, as I say, they have been very, very weak and poor the last two performances.
Matthew, going back to Aubameyang, is it a simple case of square peg, round hole? Because there's a nice problem to have when you've got Lacazette and Aubameyang, but him being utilised as a wide forward at the moment, is that really getting the best out of him?
No, I don't think it is, because I think he's always sort of been, you know, a bit of a poacher, as it were, in and around the box. And you don't want him to be creating chances. You want him to be on the receiving end. And this, you know, really does come back to the, you know, the Mesut Ozil situation. The Arsenal are lacking that creative midfielder that can get the opportunities to the likes of Lacazette and Aubameyang. But without them, it's just futile at the moment. And having to force Aubameyang out wide isn't getting the best out of him. And as a result, you're seeing what's happening on the pitch at Arsenal at the moment.
And Matthew, staying with you, the most contentious issue of the game would have been the disallowed goal in the first half for Arsenal. Two players offside, one of them sort of in the goalkeeper's line of sight. So was the right decision made there to scrap out the goal?
I think it is. It's again, it's one of these things. Casper Schmeichel will know if the likes of Xhaka and whoever the other one was, you know, properly, you know, interfering with his line of vision and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, given the way the rules are, you know, the players were offside. I don't think there can be any disputing that bit. It's whether or not they were involved. You can see it either way, but I'm not going to complain that it was disallowed. I think there was enough reason to chalk it off.
I think Aubameyang was offside, but not really interfering with the goalkeeper. Xhaka in the line of sight. And if you took the Real Madrid Shakhtar Donetsk game as a frame reference from days before, Real Madrid had an equaliser scrapped minutes from the end because of exactly that. So I think if you're sort of using that as a comparison, you can see why that goal was also chalked off. However, Max, not the goal chalked off at the very end. Jamie Vardy come off the bench. Harvey Barnes quite ineffective in that sort of top of the centre role. Not his usual role, but obviously injuries meant he had to play there. Bring on Vardy, it all changes. Leicester changed as soon as he came on, and what a change he made.
Yeah, he's just a fantastic player, and he's got a really, really good record against Arsenal as well. They must have been bricking it when they saw him coming off the bench. But a lot of that goal comes down to the other sub, who not many people are talking about, which is Cengiz Under. I really hope I've pronounced that correctly. If anyone who speaks Turkish wants to correct me, then feel free.
I think it'll be all right, Max.
Yeah. So he had a decent impact as well. And he was put in a really, really good position. And he could have shot. He was entitled to take the shot from the position he was in. But he was really unselfish. Squared it to Vardy. And you see that a lot, actually. You see a lot of players go through on goal and lose their head and, you know, swipe it over wildly or take a shot on when the keeper's closing them down and the teammate's in a better position. And when you're watching it from the sidelines or on TV or whatever, you think, oh, it must be obvious to a player that you're aware of someone who's in a better position than you. But often it isn't, even for attackers. And so it was really good awareness and unselfishness from Under to set up Vardy. But yeah, goodness me, what a phenomenon, easy for me to say, Jamie Vardy is. And if he's in that kind of goal-scoring form over the rest of the Premier League season, maybe Gareth Southgate will want to try and persuade him to come out of international retirement as well. Although, up front, with Dominic Calvert-Lewin as well.
I knew that was coming, but it's still funny all the same. So there might be a call for another kazoo in a moment, but probably not because we don't overdo the kazoo, but we'll get to that question in a bit. So, Carl, Aston Villa, they are, where are they? They're one place behind Leicester in the league, both on 12 points. Their perfect start season came to an end. Now, that's not the biggest shock, but I think a 3-0 reverse at home probably is.
Yeah, I must admit, I think we, you know, I wouldn't say we were all waiting for this, were we? Because, you know, you're sitting there looking at their start gamble. Wow, what a start considering the way they finished last season. But they've been looking good. And I must admit, I didn't see a 3-0 reverse on that one. You know, you kind of thought Leeds can play some good football. And, you know, you maybe wouldn't have been surprised if it had been nicked 1-0 or 2-1. I certainly didn't see Leeds making it as comfortable as they did. And I just think it was one of those, wasn't it? You know, Villa just weren't as good as they'd been the first few games. They didn't seem to click as well as they should have done. You know, Leeds, I think, did reasonably well at keeping Grealish sort of quiet. And I think, you know, more teams will look that if you can keep Grealish quiet, you possibly keep Villa slightly quiet. But I think, you know, Leeds played well, but Villa, I think, will be disappointed because, you know, if that's away from home, I don't think it, you know, although the loss would have hurt them, I think they'll sit there and go, well, okay, yeah, away from home, anything can happen in this league. I think they'll just be slightly disappointed that performance came at home, especially considering that, you know, the performance before that at home was the Liverpool game. And, you know, they would like to have built on that and made sure Villa Park was becoming a bit of a fortress. So, I wouldn't say we're surprised because I think we probably all were expecting it to come to an end. I just didn't see that being the game where it would. I thought they probably would have a bit too much for Leeds and given their form. So, yeah, poor performance from them, but one that they now just have to reset and make sure that, well, OK, if, you know, one game in every six is a bad game, that won't be too bad and that should see us comfortably safe by the end of this season.
So, Matthew, Patrick Bamford has always had his doubters when he tries to make the transition from the Championship to the Premier League. Can he do it? You know, he gets farmed out on another loan move and people say, oh, he's never going to get to that level. He's making a mockery of that statement. You know, he's really turning some heads at the moment. A hat-trick at Villa Park. I think that's his first ever one in the Premier League. He's finally coming of age, isn't he?
He is, absolutely. And I think if anyone paid attention to the Championship last season, it was literally a case of Patrick Bamford, because I think he still got something like 15 goals last season, but it was the fact that it took him so many chances in order to get, you know, Whereas most you know, good strikers would take probably 40 chances to get 15 goals. Bradford was taking like 100 or so. He was missing plenty and didn't have the conversion rate. But now I think after a year, no, 2 years now, under the Marcelo Bielsa system, and now he's got a bit more high quality of player working with him now than when he first started at Leeds, for instance. I think now it's just all come to fruition now that he's a lot more comfortable in the season, and he is starting to make a lot of people, as you say, look foolish. And I just want to touch on what Carl was saying. I honestly wasn't that shocked that the result came the way it is. I think Leeds have tried to sort of announce themselves to the league with their performance at Anfield on the first day of the season. I think now, given the start that Aston Villa had, if everyone isn't paying attention to Leeds and what they're doing now, I think they are now. They can be a real force in this division. And I said they were going to be camps to be safe. I honestly would not be surprised if they can crack the top half and even make a run at a Wolves-style European space when they came up and finished seventh. I honestly wouldn't put it past them.
Well, this is going to be the next point to Max, actually, because I know we shouldn't read too much into the table at this early stage and with results, you know, being as they are, but you still got to earn points regardless. And will Marcel Bielsa be happy with sixth place, or knowing Marcel Bielsa, will he actually be a little bit disappointed at the same time?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the second half of your question there, because you would think on the face of it that Bielsa will be very happy with the performances so far. You know, they took Liverpool a long, long way in the first game of the season. You know, they really, really pushed them all the way, and they obviously trounced Villa, who were top of the table and unbeaten very comfortably. But the point is with Bielsa is that he's such a stickler. And he's got such high standards that he isn't going to allow them to rest on their laurels and think, oh, yeah, you know, we've started the season pretty well. We've been competitive. Yeah, you know, we'll probably stay up this season. That is just absolutely not how he works. And he's going to be keen for them to continue to build and improve and work as hard or even harder than they have so far. And if that does happen and Bamford keeps scoring the goals, which is not something I predicted, given how absolutely pants he was for Crystal Palace on loan a couple of years back. And if Bamford keeps scoring, they've got a really good chance of doing a Wolves and getting a European slot, or doing a Sheffield United and you know, coming comfortably top half, because they look a really good side. And imagine how much better they're going to be when they've got the kind of partisan, febrile Leeds crowd behind them as well in person.
Absolutely. You know, I think the Premier League has already been warned. So, you know, dare I say, they're only going to get better, which is a worry for those teams in and around the top four, top six. Right, let's mop up the rest of the Premier League. There's still a little bit of admin still to do. So, Carl, I'll give you Old Trafford. Not the best game. Far from it, actually. But from a Chelsea point of view, it certainly makes a difference when you've got a confident keeper at the back of the team.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, as you say, Dan, it was a bit of a snore fest, wasn't it, for the sort of hype that sort of game gets. But as you say, the confidence and the way the keeper played and some of the saves he pulled off, especially the Rashford one near the end, brilliant save. He probably would have needed that as well. Again, a confidence boost. It lets his team know that actually, yeah, look, this is going to be a good goalkeeper we got behind us now. And that sort of thing just spreads confidence throughout the team. So, yeah, that'll be a really good, you know, shining light for Chelsea to come away. And like I say, from a game that really was just a bit of a damp squid and didn't live up to the expectation. And obviously, I'm sure we're going to say, you know, Chelsea will feel massively aggrieved by the fact that, you know, the WWE RKO in the penalty box wasn't given as it should have been, because that was a disgraceful decision, how that doesn't get you know, reviewed and turned into a penalty, because I don't know what more you've got to do to give a penalty away when jumping with someone.
Oh, it's ludicrous. And that, do you know what? That was the exact image I had in my mind. If I was more graphically tuned, I would have tried to have made that picture, because it's exactly just an RKO. You hit the nail absolutely on the head, Carl. Where should we go next? Let's go to Molineux, Matthew, because Wolves-Newcastle played out a 1-1 draw. I think, really, 2 points dropped for the hosts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, very much so. Now, I talked about earlier about, you know, results getting back to normal. This is just one of those results where it was back to normal, because you would expect Wolves who have just run over completely Newcastle. But yeah, I think this is more of a credit to Steve Bruce sort of things. I know he's had a lot of detractors and a lot of, you know, anti-Bruce sentiment, as it were. But I think once he properly gets into this squad, and the fact he can line them up to frustrate teams, as he has done over the years with his previous teams, if he wants someone to grind out a result, Steve Bruce will do that. So whilst you may say 2 points drop, I think it may also be a case of 1 point very, very well earned from Newcastle.
Oh, of course, yeah. Give Newcastle credit as well. I mean, if they can go across the whole season by only losing, what, a third of their matches, if you took this current six-match sample and extrapolated that across the season, they stay up and it's job done. So, yeah, I think credit has to go to Newcastle as well. Max, another draw, Brighton West Brom. On the face of that, is that a better point for the Baggies than it is the Seagulls?
Yeah, I think so. Brighton were obviously at home. You know, they dominated a lot of the possession, as they often do, to be fair. You know, they dominate the possession against Palace as well. But even though they've got on paper quite a nice front three in Leandro Trossard and Adam Lallana and Neil Maupay, they've been struggling to be clinical, and that continued against West Brom. Obviously, as a Palace fan, I was really pleased to see West Brom get the equaliser at the end through Carlin Grant with his first Premier League goal in his debut, I believe. And to be honest, it was a really good point for the Baggies, especially considering the context in which it came, in that they sold Ahmed Hegazi, the Egyptian centre-back who started the last game, if I remember correctly. And Bilic, this is mad, Bilic came out and was saying he was angry about Hegazi being sold, and it was being done behind his back, and it wasn't his choice, and, you know, he thought Hegazi was part of his squad. And given all that turmoil and the seeming infighting behind the scenes, which you wouldn't expect Slaven Bilic to be particularly sympathetic towards, it was a really good point, because, you know, Brighton have aspirations to be a much better Premier League team and higher up the table, but they've struggled so far this season. Nonetheless, as I say, a really good point for West Brom, and considering how late it came, it's a better point for them than it is for Brighton.
I think the way the Premier League table is shaping up, I think the bottom five will be the bottom five. I know the points margins aren't that much at the moment, but we're just seeing a little bit of a sort of the haves and the have-nots. I think that's probably going to be the quintet that are struggling to stay up come the end of the season. And in that quintet are Burnley. So from a Spurs point of view, I'm going to keep my powder dry, because me and Carl will be catching up in a few hours to do a Cover New Spurs pod. So if you want to listen to Spurs sort of slant of that, listen to that one. But Burnley, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes, so let's focus on them, because we haven't really touched them this season. So apologies to any Burnley fans out there. But Carl, a bad start for them again. Now, when you look at it from, what, was it 2 seasons ago when they were in the Europa League? That was the reason for their bad start. Yeah. Now, they haven't got that excuse. So where's it gone wrong for them?
Yeah, I think, you know, Burnley, you know, they've been unfortunate this season. You know, they've played reasonably well, just haven't got the results that they probably, some of their performances should have done. But again, in this league, you know, you can't cry about that. It's a results business. They've obviously got a reasonable squad, but they're not able to invest, you know, millions and bring in star names. They probably need, you know, they're going to need to be a little bit more ruthless going forward, because last night, you know, they had some good chances. Even though they didn't have a lot of the ball, they looked the more threatening. And as I say, at a certain point in the second half, they actually looked like they could be the team that nicked the result. Again, got a little bit sloppy from the corner. But I don't think they're playing bad, and I think they will get it together enough where suddenly the results will come. They'll see themselves kind of mid-table. But again, I think they are going to look to see where do they see themselves going in, say, a couple more years. Dyche is doing a brilliant job right now, but how long can you do that before suddenly the wheels start to fall off and you do start to go backwards? But they haven't played badly. I think they just need to be a little bit more ruthless when they do get their chances.
Matthew, has a case of investment, or lack thereof, shall we say, in the summer started to be their downfall?
Yeah, absolutely. Touching on what Carl said, I think we said for a couple of years, you know, go back, Wigan were more or less in the same situation. There's only really so much a team like them can do without the money and everything like that. Bournemouth, you can more or less make the same mistake, make the same argument, last year, that eventually, I think that this is now just Burnley's time, I think. As there is only so far that you can go without, you know, properly properly buying into a squad and trusting Sean Dyche to, you know, pull out the miracle as he always has. And I think this is just, it's just finally caught up with them. I don't want that to be the case, because I do like Sean Dyche, and I do think he will be the next England manager after Gareth Southgate. Oh, hang on. I suppose that means... he will get the job when Gareth Southgate retires or leaves or whatever the thing is. So I don't wish harm on Sean Dyche or anything like that, but I just think the time has naturally come for a squad like Burnley to just go around gracefully.
Matthew, I think you're allowed a maximum of 2 kazoos per episode. I think we need to ration them so we don't undervalue the kazoo.
You still laugh, don't say
true.
You
that
don't
is true. That is true. But anyway, Max, Sean Dyche is a name which is sometimes linked with Crystal Palace. So if we look into our crystal ball, we'll take a bit of a leap of faith here. Let's say Burnley do go down and Roy finally calls time on his lengthy career. Is Dyche the next man to come into Selhurst Park?
Well, not to preempt the Sean Dyche kazoo, but I think he could be. I think he honestly could be, because he's a Londoner. He obviously played for Watford in his playing career. He's playing a similar style of play at Burnley as he is at Crystal Palace. You know, the low block, looking to counter-attack teams, soak up pressure, not have much possession. And so he's kind of, for me, he's the best manager that we could realistically get, given how good he is at working with a squad on a tight budget and, you know, often with not many options in his squad, making the most of the players he has, developing players he signs. For example, James Tarkowski was signed from Oldham and is now an England international. You know, he's got a real record of improving players, giving young players a chance as well, players like Dwight McNeil, and things like that, and Jimmy Dunn, centre-back, earlier this season. So with Palace's history of trying to develop youth players, I think he'd be a really, really good fit for us, and I'd be delighted if we got him.
Right, that is the end of the show. We're just on the nose of about an hour. So well done, chaps. We squeezed everything in. I just need to do the admin, which is as simple as thanking my great guests, as per usual. So Max, thank you for your time this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed that one.
Yeah, very much, very much. I'm hoping for a kazoo-filled episode next week as well.
Yes, on that note, thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Cheers, mate. And Carl, the captain's armband, but I'm going to have to fine you £20 wages for your late appearance this afternoon.
Oh, I think that's you're letting me off lightly there, Dan. So really enjoyed this one when I made it. You know, the Ferrari wouldn't start. but yeah, we'll be back next week, all in good time.
Top man, yeah. As long as you're back next week, that'll be absolutely fine. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.